I need your help this morning as my Sunday church experience got off to a rough start. I went to get my whole wheat oatmeal bagel, spread it with my olive and pimento cream cheese, took my first bite, and it burned hot. That jalapeno cream cheese looks exactly like olive and pimento, flecked with green and red. So pray with me as I try to recover. Jesus, I invite your presence here. Help us to understand the kind of space you mean this to be. As we cross the threshold into that stable, as we tread on the holy mountain that Juanita and Olivia just led us into, give us a picture, an experience of who you are and what you bring to us through your coming into our world. Amen. Well, I need prayer because my task for the morning is daunting. Let me put up the first slide. My hope is to help us understand how this has become transformed through our Christmas practice into this. Now, I hope this isn't one of your homes. I apologize if it has become a part of the object lesson for us this morning. The question is, are they connected in some way? I was walking down my street of a night recently, looking at the decorations of my neighbor's homes, and I had a thought. I wondered if we're not so much, when we decorate our homes, embellishing them as they are, but rather trying to create a different place. That when you and I cross the threshold of our Christmas-enhanced homes, or invite others to come into our Christmas space, that we're not so much, you know, doing a modified version of what it always is, but trying to create an alternative world, a fantastical place, a magical place, a fantasy realm. I mean, you think about how we decorate. We use glitter and sparkles that glow with magic. Silver lights, white lights, blue lights. We now can use the LED projectors, right? That display onto our homes in precise detail a completely other place than what it used to be. I think, too, about the stories that we tell. They're different at Christmas time than stories for any other holiday. We take the Polar Express to this place in the North Pole where a whole population of people make gifts for us all year. We go with Marie and the Nutcracker to slay the Mouse King. In a magical realm where the inanimate dolls come to life at night. We visit the Who's in Whoville, where the power of their love can cause a shriveled heart to expand with generosity. And that's a part of, too, I think, of what makes our anticipation of this season different. It's not just a bright place where you get lots of good stuff. But there's this intuition that during this season, human nature can change. You and I can become different kinds of beings than what we were before, in business as usual. You can show the next slide. This epitomizes the desire that this curmudgeonly individual adamantly opposed to being kind, perpetrating his own form of violence against those over whom he has power. When he comes into contact with the Christmas spirit, he is transformed into somebody who is joyfully generous. Right? Not by effort of will, overcoming something on the inside that's resisting. He is a different person, laughing, jubilant, taking delight in flinging his money to all those who have need. And so I think maybe there's something to that. Right? That beneath our exuberant embellishments of our homes, there lurks this notion that in the Christmas space is a different kind of realm. That is what you and I anticipate, hope for, long for, when we imagine crossing the threshold into that stable, that we enter a different kind of space, an alternative universe, with rules and nature unlike anything that we encounter in the ordinary run-of-the-mill day here. Well, to help us explore that possibility, we're going to go into the passage that Juanita and Olivia presented to us this morning. These Advent passages, to me, seem kind of like, sometimes, I experience them like my Christmas decorations. You know, we go down into the cellar and pull out our Christmas crate every year, a few weeks before Christmas, put up some decorations. January 1, we take them down and they submerge again. They come out the next year. Well, somebody across the course of time in the history of Christianity has felt that there were texts of old from the Jewish tradition that God used to point towards, in our minds, Jesus, to help us make meaning of the coming of God's Son in the world. And these Advent scriptures sometimes feel kind of like those Christmas decorations. We take these passages that somebody thought was meaningful and would be helpful, we read them on a morning like this, and then they submerge again. So my experiment for the morning was to say, well, let's take a look at one of these. Why not the one we're reading this morning? And see if there's something more to it. See if it provides help in you and I getting a deeper meaning of the coming of Jesus into our world. And lo and behold, when I did that, it has turned out to be amazing. So, if, as I had that construct, you were paying close attention, you might have noticed that the reading from this morning falls into two main sections. The first in which Isaiah, the person presenting to us these words, describes an individual, a leader with remarkable qualities that produce a very impressive style of leadership. The second section describes what living life under the influence of this leader in the domain of his leadership is like. It turns out to be a very strange and bizarre place. Now, the primary picture that Isaiah used to lead us into, or to introduce us to this leader, was something that probably is familiar to most of us that we could visualize pretty quickly. A tendril of growth, a shoot, it's called, growing up from a dead tree stump. This gives rise to everything else that follows for Isaiah. But to understand the meaningfulness of this to Isaiah. And I think what God means for us to get from this image, we need to put it in its context. So the person speaking, the person presenting this image, this vision, these words, would have been known to the people of his day as a prophet. What they would have understood that to mean is an individual who pays close attention to what's going on in the world around them and is informed in their meaning-making by some influence from God. So they have a God-influenced ability to make meaning of the affairs of human beings. And then occasionally, as this person, as this prophet is doing that, they might catch a glimpse of something to come, right? They might get a clue, oh, I think I know how things are going to unfold going forward. Oh, there's a future occurrence that will be meaningful, particularly given the context in which I'm perceiving it. Now, we tend to pay attention to that part of it. Ooh, prophecy is predicting the future. But for the most part, the bread and butter of what they did was this meaning-making from the perspective of God, or informed by God's perceptions. So what we have in the reading from this morning is an example of the latter, a future occurrence that the prophet becomes aware of. But it's informed by a whole lot of interpretation of what's going on in the world around Isaiah, which, in Isaiah's chapters 8, 9, and 10, was not very good. So Isaiah lives in a time not that much different from all other human times where people are not getting along very well. He looks around at the landscape and he sees individuals being unkind to each other, groups being mean to each other, humans motivated by all sorts of envy, greed, self-absorption, insecurity, that's producing, first and foremost, violence. Just all kinds of harm that humans are perpetrating against each other. And one of the central images, Isaiah being a prophet, is prone to using images, metaphors, visions, things like that, pictures. A central image is that of the decimation, whether by fire or human destruction, of a forest. So here, for example, he says, wickedness burned like a fire, consuming briars and thorns. It kindled the thickets of the forest, and they swirled upward in a column of smoke. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land was burned, and the people became like fuel for the fire. No one spared another. So this is a very dark vision of what's going on, where the image of a consuming fire represents how human beings are treating each other. Now, interestingly, this will become relevant in what he sees for the future, injustice is a central form of violence and harm that human beings are perpetrating against each other. Ah, you who make iniquitous decrees, who write oppressive statutes, to turn aside the needy from justice and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be your spoil, and that you may make the orphans your prey. What will you do on the day of punishment and the calamity that will come from far away? Right, so as Isaiah surveys the scene and sees the various forms of violence that human beings are perpetrating against each other, producing this destruction, the misuse of power by the powerful against those without powerful for their own benefit, is one of the most reprehensible. The light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and will burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. The glory of his forest and his fruitful land the Lord will destroy, both soul and body, and it will be as when an invalid wastes away. The remnant of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child could list them. And as Isaiah comes to the end of this apocalyptic deforestation vision, he pictures God jumping from one place to another, one town, one village, one region, one country, perceiving the destruction and the anxiety that it causes.
He has gone up from Rimnon. He has come to Aiath. He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he stores his baggage. They have crossed over the pass. At Geba, they lodge for the night. Ramah trembles. Gibeah of Saul has fled. Cry aloud, O daughter Galim. Listen, O Laisha. Answer her, O Anathoth. Madmanah is in flight. The inhabitants of Gabim flee for safety. This very day he will halt at Nob. He will shake his fist at the mount of daughter Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Look, the sovereign, the Lord of hosts, will lop the boughs with terrifying power. The tallest trees will be cut down, and the lofty will be brought low. He will hack down the thickets of the forest with an axe, and Lebanon with its majestic cedars will fall. For this apocalyptic wasteland of burning, hewn down trees. I try to imagine what Isaiah is seeing. I sort of picture him, eyes closed, this vision that represents the state of human affairs filling his mind. You can show the next slide. This is a picture from the deforestation of the Pacific Northwest. The 1900s. You can show the next slide. Forest fire of the kinds that have been ravaging California. Gray ashes, smoke. No life. As far the horizon as the eye can see. I imagine this filling the mind of Isaiah, right? This is what he is seeing. This is the image that represents the kind of life or absence thereof produced by the violence of humans perpetrated against each other. And then we see something else. My understanding of the way that our eyes work is that our retinas are so sensitive that the light receptors can detect one photon of light touching them. Then a field of darkness, of blackness, that one photon can activate your retina to say, oh, look there, something's there. I detected something. And so I imagine Isaiah then, as he surveys this scene of emptiness, of waste, looking. And there in the distance, he sees something. You can show the next slide. But a branch will emerge from the trunk of Jesse, a shoot will grow from his roots. So this isn't just traipsing through the forest, you know, here's a tree stump with a little tendril growing from it. This is surveying emptiness, absence of life, and seeing off in the distance a little tendril, a shoot that's emerging from one of the stumps. And in all of the grayness, Isaiah's attention is drawn to it. Oh, look at that. He says, oh my goodness, what is that? He makes his way through the ashes, through the destruction, to this thing, this frail little hint, fragment of life, so fragile. But he knows, with his God-informed perspective and insight, he knows, oh, this is it. This is the thing in all of this wasteland to pay attention to. This carries the meaning. This is life going forward. And he immediately has the sense that it represents a person, a kind of person coming into the world that is different, a kind of leader. The Spirit of God will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowing and fearing God. He will be inspired by fearing God. And so this, too, for Isaiah, as he's imagining, as he's perceiving, this new kind of human being, this new kind of leader coming into a human community,
This person stands in stark contrast to all the others that came before. All the others who were inspired by fear of death, fear of irrelevance, fear of being overpowered, fear of deprivation. This one is inspired by knowing and fearing God. And because of that, the Spirit of God rests on this one, is comfortable on this one, stays on this one, abides in this one. And this resonance with the Spirit of God produces a remarkable interaction with human beings and human systems. He will not judge by what his eyes see or by what his ears hear, but he will judge the impoverished justly. He will decide fairly for the humble of the land. Isn't that remarkable? Right? I've spent quite a few years coming to terms with things in me like privilege and implicit bias, learning that what I take to be objective perceptions of people around me are completely covered by culture and prejudice and things like that. And here God is saying, yeah, I knew about that like 3,000 years ago. This is not news to me, that what comes to you through your eyes and through your ears that you take as factually accurate truth is completely colored by your misperceptions of reality. Let me tell you that when my new leader comes who is informed by knowing me and fearing me, that person will make accurate assessments of what is the case in systems of power and justice and allocation. He will strike the land with a rod from his mouth and slay the wicked with a breath from his lips. Justice will be the belt around his waist, faithfulness the sash around his hips. So the scene then switches. You have this picture of a leader who's come. The scene then switches in this way that I would imagine for Isaiah would be just profoundly disorienting. It would be as if when you entered church this morning, the greeter handed you your bulletin. They also handed you a pair of those glasses that cause everything to be reversed. Right? So that left becomes right and right becomes left. So we're all wearing these glasses where we're bumping into each other and like, oh, I don't know which way to go, and we can't figure out it. So this morning we end up in the kids' wing. You know, expecting to be here. Because the scene shifts suddenly. And Isaiah comes upon this scene, this most bizarre zoo ever. Like you have to picture, you have to imagine Isaiah seeing this. The first thing you see is the wolf will live with the lamb. So it's not the wolf will refrain from eating the lamb, or the lamb and the wolf will eye each other warily. They're living together. They're cohabitating. They're planning a meal. They're watching TV as the day winds down. They're co-parenting their strangely blended family. Going to sleep together at night in the same bed. Isaiah moves from that, and he sees the leopard lying down with the kid, with the baby goat, right? Comes into a clearing, they're nestled together, lying down. Calf, young lion, you get the sense that God really wants Isaiah to get this, right? Because the animals just keep coming. There are 12 of them. Calf, young lion, and fattened lamb. So not just an ordinary lamb now, but a fat, chubby little thing. With a little child to lead them, cow and bear will feed together. Their young will lie down together. And then the lion will eat straw like the ox, and all of the vegetarians go, woo! We win! Right? But that captures the meaning of what's going on, the image of the animals. It's not just that all the animals are getting along together, it's that those animals that devoured the others have stopped doing so. That's the difference. Those animals that, because of their power, perpetrated violence against others for the sake of their own consumption, their very natures have changed. It's not, again, that they're really resisting, "Oh, that is the fattest lamb I've ever seen. Oh, but I'll take some hay, okay." They just don't have it in themselves to do that anymore in this strange new world. And then to top it all off, we're not done, to top it all off are the children, right? We've gone straight from adults to the most vulnerable, and it is like the worst parenting ever. My wife and I, our oldest son and his wife, are coming to visit us. They're coming this afternoon with their daughter, our one granddaughter. So you can be sure that all of the outlets in our home will be covered. If we had our way, we'd go to our neighbor's homes. Cover those. We'd send an advanced team out to any place we're going to visit. The grocery store, the children's museum. But here, you know, and again, I'm trying to imagine Isaiah seeing this. Little, you know, the parents are saying to little Junior, "Oh, you lost your viper? I think it went back into its hole. Just reach in there and get it." Right? And Isaiah's watching and thinking, "Oh, that's just so wrong." Nesting, like sleeping on the hole of the cobra. "Oh, yeah. Yeah, she takes it to bed with her at night. It's so sweet." I mean, the image of the non-violence and non-harm in this place is astounding. It's a different world that God is imagining will come from this shoot. And he finishes it, "They will not hurt or destroy anywhere on my holy mountain, for the earth will be as full of the knowing of God as water covering the sea. On that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The Gentiles will seek him out, and the place where he rests will be glorious." Right? So this place, the holy mountain of God, characterized by this open generosity, nonviolence, absence of people harming each other, motivated and inspired by the knowing of God. So I think, yeah, I can see that. That helps me understand, for example, the joy of the angels, where they truly have a global perspective. They look down on the human community in all its disarray, and they see this little fragile hint of a life in a small, dusty place of an oppressed country. And they think, yeah, that's it. That's where the meaning lies. I think of myself as I imagine crossing the threshold into that stable. And I do imagine it as a place of peace, where the rules are different, where my nature can be transformed. I try to imagine where it happens for me in this world here and now. The first place that came to mind for me was the front room of my spiritual director's home. I go there once a month or so. I remember the first time I went there in the midst of a whole lot of anxiety, mostly because of the rules that had come to me through my practice of religion that produced a way of life characterized by a lot of anxiety, and it turned out violence. The first thing my spiritual director says to me is, "Tom, why are you so hard on yourself? Why do you think God sees you in that way? God loves you just as you are." The rules in that space were so different than the rules I had come to understand as governing life in the religious world. So I think the invitation is there for you and for me to find that space this Christmas season. My hope is that this can be that kind of space. I know that for some of us, when we enter these walls, we truly have the experience that this is, as we said before, a condemnation-free zone. That the welcome here into the God space of connecting with Jesus is real and is available to all. So, I invite the band to come forward. And as they do, I just want to invite you into a moment of prayer. Jesus, you come into our world bringing this kind of reality with you. You are a different kind of person, a different kind of leader, and you bring knowing God to us. It can fill us up. It can surround us. It can bring us into this kind of space of welcome, of justice, of freedom, where our natures, where we can experience being in a place where we are not under threat, and where we can turn around and be the same, where we can be transformed. I pray that even now, God, you would show us how that can happen with us, that you would show us the spaces in our world where that's the case, where we can go and find that. Show us what that can be like with us.